Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents An Unruled Body, a Poet's Memoir by Ani Jika. Narrated by Ani Jika. For my parents, for Anita Hoffer, and for Rebecca Loudon, who once wished for me a desire to engage in deep play in my art. When we are young, the words are scattered all around us. As they are assembled by experience, so also are we, sentence by sentence, until the story takes shape. Louise Erdrich, The Plague of Doves. Prologue. I am here, in my car, alone, driving home from an employee Christmas party to Ishan, the man I married 6.5 years ago, who told me on Thanksgiving morning that he's leaving me. At this very moment, I feel pure joy, though not the kind that makes you worry the evil eye might get you. Not tonight, and not at all in the years that will follow, when I allow joy to enter my body, my home. I am driving on Main Street, suddenly very aware of how the layers of my clothes fit. I am wearing a black, unbuttoned, A-shaped coat, and underneath it a tight peacock blue-green shirt, over a long copper satin skirt. My curls are doing that shiny no-frizz thing they do only once a week, kissing my shoulders and framing my face as if they're offering it. I am particularly enjoying the way my skirt feels against my skin, against my free, silky, smooth legs. Driving through an intersection, I have the urge to open my legs, and when I do, I feel an unlocking. I can't close them. I already know that I won't. I feel pleasantly dizzy and think, I shouldn't do this. It's not safe. But the thought flashes away faster than the people and cars I'm passing. I put one hand on my lap and begin lifting the cloth toward my belly, feeling charged, charging with every inch of movement I'm now causing. It doesn't take long before I let my finger enter, then slip out, and enter again. First one finger, then two. My hand seems to know this new way of finding me, of finding how to touch so that each time is new and keeps changing my breathing. And if people see me, the thought briefly intercedes. But I feel such pleasure from the fact that I'm doing this now, driving in public, that no one is watching, yet they could so easily discover me if they only looked. I am moaning. When my fingers no longer trace circles on my vulva or within the opening, when they thrust in and out now, finding their rhythm, I stop breathing, and I'm so wet, for a moment I wonder where I'll wipe this hand. With each stroke and thrust, I grow softer, wetter, wider. I have become an opening. All the layers of inhibition, fears, anxiety, insecurities I'd wrapped myself in for years shed from me, dissolved, the way you know pain only while going through it. Afterward, the memory of it is mercurial. Did it really exist? I am the lake after a stone falls in. With each thrust, another ripple widens, bigger than the previous, and I'm rippling out and out. I feel multiplied and distinctly singular at once. I am here in my car, and dispersed through the universe at the same time. My throat is dry. When I'm a child, my father finds me in daycare one afternoon, sitting on a chair behind the door, mouth full of peas, not swallowing them, not spitting them out. The daycare worker had started to feed me, but I don't like peas and won't have them, so she punished me by making me sit behind the door after she force-fed a couple of spoonfuls. I am 3 years old, and I know I've done something wrong. But I like to believe I am punishing her right back, in my own way, by holding a mouthful of peas, cheeks swollen, determined not to swallow until the world ends. It will take decades for me to be this resolute again, when my body will learn to control my actions. But I don't know that now. My mother brags that I've been strong-willed since I was young. But when my father, the storyteller, talks about this day, he often praises my ability to endure. "Oh, Annie," he says, "there's no one like her. She's the most patient. Have I told you about the time I went to pick her up from daycare and found her?" And he laughs, the way only someone who means well laughs. But I don't agree. This isn't a story about endurance. This is a story about listening to the language of my body, how I learned to listen, to remember all that I am. Before writing, before toys, I used to draw stars. Mommy sat knitting me a sweater, advising from time to time how to make an angle. In Albania, language finds me before I can read. For years, I listened to my grandmother's stories from the Old Testament and recite the nursery rhymes she teaches me. Aside from a few days I spend at daycare, I play indoors and outside in the neighborhood until I begin to attend public school in first grade. For the first 6 years of my life, I listen and absorb the language of what surrounds me. Books, grown-ups, dirt, nature, parades, my mother ironing clothes on Sundays. Language finds me again after I turn 7, the day Enver Hoxha dies. I write poetry to make sense of the Albanian tyrant's death. But I lose it in the years that follow, when my country suffers the tragedies that accumulate, when one system is toppled and everyone waits, dreaming of something better to take the old one's place. From the vantage of my 11 or 12-year-old eyes, it seems as though my country, determined to change itself overnight, has become a bullet train that derails and lands in a swamp, the engine pistons slowly but inevitably coming to a halt. I watch from a distance, the way young girls watch without speaking when the shape of their body is a threat to their own existence. It will take years for me to find language again, no longer my mother tongue, but the language of America, the country in which my family and I will eventually arrive, the language I will later embrace as a writer and a translator. I begin writing one April day my sophomore year in college, 2 years after immigrating to America. Maybe I have a crush on Ben, the son of family friends who live nearby, and maybe I have fallen in love with the poetry I read as a newly declared English major, but I grab a notebook and a pen, sit by the fire stairs of the house my family and I are living in, and write the whole afternoon, 30 little poems. This happens to me rarely, the flood of having something to say and the immediate need to write it down. But I trust it when it comes. Later, as I move from one continent to another, from one language to another, writing becomes my only way home. All the emotions and stories I carry exist outside language, in my body, where they live. I am more at home on the page than when I speak English or Albanian. There is always a disconnect, the sense that someone will know the misfit I am as soon as I open my mouth. But when I'm writing, I'm sailing on a small boat at dusk in the middle of a lake. So much has quieted. The birds, the sunlight, the people who have walked back into their houses, and so much of what is absent begins to resound and ripple around the little boat. Everything I write comes from this heart space and seeks to give itself, to be shared. There is no critical voice, only the sense of something warm lapping at my boat, ushering me toward the shore, toward trusting that I am exactly where I should be. It is only through writing that I ever arrive anywhere. There is love on this shore. Love is where I am. In the car, I look at myself in the rearview mirror. I love how I look. My eyes are calm, knowing that nothing can hurt me here. I neither seek to find nor fear to lose language at this moment. I have become language, spoken, pronounced, spelled out. I look at myself in the mirror. I am 33 years old, perhaps subconsciously willing my own resurrection. And no one else but my husband knows this. In our 6 years of marriage, we have never had sex. Part 1. How to love. 1. For a long time, I can't understand why my grandmother Merope hides her Bible under her pillow when the doorbell rings. Later, I learn what it means to live a secret Christian life in an atheist country like Albania. You have two lives, at least two, and you better keep track of which one stays at home and which one is allowed outside. My grandmother is a devout Christian who converted from Greek Orthodox to Seventh-day Adventist before the Second World War broke out. In 1990, when communism collapses in Albania, she will be one of few Seventh-day Adventist survivors. For almost 50 years, she'll keep her tithe, $533.89, in a cookie tin until she is finally baptized in April 1992 at the age of 87 and can deliver her contribution to new missionaries from England. When I am a girl, my grandmother is my world. After my parents pull me out of daycare, my grandmother moves in with us to raise my younger brother and me while they are at work. She follows me around the house with a glass of milk, sometimes all the way out to the yard, so I can drink that daily dose, which I hate. She is a mouth of stories and prayers. She prays kneeling near a sofa, making sure it is the one facing north, and at night she prays like Daniel in the Bible. Sometimes I wake to her whole body in the moonlight, first standing in the room and then kneeling, then on her hands and feet, until she lies face down and whispers on and on for a good 10 minutes. "Nana," I call, so she knows I'm awake. "Shh, go back to sleep," she says. Other times she laughs and says, "You're still awake, Annie? Come, child, I'll pray with you." Then approaches my bedside, kneels next to me, and begins, "O ato perandi kretari chili dei deot. O Father, O God, ruler of the heavens and earth." And I know God is all over, all around us. I can still hear her telling me the story of Daniel in the lion's den and of Samson. My favorite part is when Samson finds honey in the belly of the slain lion. When my grandmother reaches this part, her lips soften and her speech slows down. I think she knows exactly where that honey came from, as though she's tasted it sometime in her past. Her lips and speech, even her gaze, have that knowledge. On summer days, when my parents are at work, my grandmother lets me get lost on the floor with brown, leather-bound Russian encyclopedias of literature. They are larger than my lap, so I have to sit on the floor with them. I don't know the language, but I can see the images in black and white, which leaves me spellbound. My mom jokes that Grandma knows exactly how to keep me entertained, so she can read her Bible for hours. Anyone who knows her believes it. She lets me go out to the balcony, stand on the chair, and recite all the poems and nursery rhymes I know by heart to the neighborhood below. One day she counts. "She recited 41 poems," she tells my parents. She will brag about it for years. On winter mornings, when I get up early and she is still in bed, warm under the covers in a house that often has no heat, as is common in those days, she will say, "Give me your hands." And she will tuck them under her 3 or 4 blankets inside her shirt so they will warm up quickly against her soft flesh. And when I start school, she will kiss me each morning before I go and read me a verse from the Bible. I can't leave the house until she reads the verse to me. It is the same for my parents and my brother. This is her way of sending us out into the world with the Word of God on our shoulders, a protective hand, and I grow superstitious that getting good grades in school has everything to do with my grandmother's ritualistic morning blessing. In the spring and summer, I capture living things, first butterflies, then fireflies, then snails and ladybugs, and ants and flies. Then I simply pluck daisies and make chains to wear or put on my mother's head. My best friend, a boy named Miri, runs with me for what feels like hours after lunch, along the riverbank, trying to capture monarch butterflies, yellow and orange, past the veiny violet flowers that old grandmas in the neighborhood say make really good tea. All I see is green, violet, yellow, orange, and Miri's white legs in his brown sandals running ahead of me, both of us wielding butterfly nets as he yells, "Come on, Ani, run faster, get this one." On my birthday, my uncle Ladi gives me a see-through jewelry box. I fill it with blades of grass, a flower, a fly, an ant, a ladybug. Here in the palm of my hand, I hold a whole forest. I watch to see how its inhabitants get along with each other. I add a dead ant to see if the others care, but soon discover there are no good Samaritans in nature. When school starts, I long for long, sunny summer holidays. When summer arrives, I spend it running, curious about the things that suddenly surround me. My brother and I chase lizards. We sit for hours waiting for them to come out of their holes. We throw stones at them. I always miss. We love to watch snails come out of their shells and sit quietly, expecting to see their delicate little horns emerge from their houses. They are such slow creatures, always coming into the outside world as if they are just being born. They make me impatient. I take a stone and hit one of them, but I don't kill anything. Sometimes when I'm alone, I pick up shards of green bottle glass and look at the world through their width, a whole world, greens and greening. I can't take my eyes off it. I have no stuffed toys, dolls, or much of anything to play with. The sidewalk is my toy, endlessly transforming, and green is everywhere. In the trees around our house, by the Lana River that runs close by, in the shards of broken wine bottles from the nearby Hotel Urbana, where many weddings take place on Sunday nights. Men and women drink till early morning, singing ballads that come at me from around all the corners of darkness over my bed. In the darkness, green is not seen. But did you ever squeeze your eyes shut, press on your eyelids till you'd see fireworks? A supernova of color. That year, winter threatened our small house. I heard winds howl, but I had drawn enough stars to burn in the stove to keep us warm. I am trying to capture something that does not belong to me, but the child cannot relate to this. She is doing what comes naturally, chasing after living things, herself a brand new living thing among them. When she makes daisy chains and gives one to her mother to wear, she is also pulling her mother into the world where they all belong. The petals are white and velvety. The sunlight pulls around her ankles and over the entire field, and time slows down. There is always enough time to make one more flower necklace, no matter how intricate the process. Or maybe this mother waits, and would wait forever, for the child to keep trying. The butterflies, the ladybugs, the flies, the ants, all the living things captured, sometimes released, sometimes accidentally hurt or killed. She will spot them and point a finger like a child naming stars for the first time, a god standing next to her. But who is God now? And when does a child stop naming the world to herself? 2. I meet my husband Ishan through an online poetry workshop when I am 22 years old. He is 20. We come to know each other online, too. I am a young immigrant in the U.S., and he lives in India. The members of the workshop come from all over the world. I have been in the States for 4 years and have just begun to feel comfortable writing in English. It is a time when I can't stop writing poetry. Ishan and I connect instantly while critiquing and exchanging our work through our love for literature and words. He loves how I write about places and people. I love his acrobatic sentences. His poetry is strange, describing a life so remote and distant from the one I have lived in Albania and in the U.S. He writes beautiful, memorable narratives with extended similes and original, vivid metaphors about lives dominated by strong male figures, barbers, village people, and cows that huddled like piles of laundry in the middle of the street. He weaves images effortlessly out of the air. People talk of love at first sight. For us, from the start, it is love at first words. The first time Ishan sends me something in the mail, it is an odd-looking package, a thick envelope wrapped in a gauzy material that smells of closets in locked rooms no one lives in, rooms I somehow already know I have been in. It smells like soil, this idea that someone all the way in India has something to say to me. I am alone at home when it arrives, take it upstairs to my room, sit on the floor, and open it. Ernest Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls, a book he loves, with two large notebook pages written back to back in his sparse, hurried handwriting, but with which you can tell he has taken greater care. Inside Hemingway's book, I find pressed leaves from the trees around Ishan's town and a few photos. He has sent them because he knows I like pressing flowers and leaves in my own books. He has also sent photographs. The first one shows him and his best friend Ashok outside Ishan's father's U-Bolt manufacturing factory. Two young teenagers in flip-flops, t-shirts, and jogging pants sit against the wall. Ashok looks at the camera, smiling, whereas Ishan looks straight ahead to his left with that big smile on his face I will later recognize as his look after he has cracked a joke. They are sitting at the foot of the wall, a window with iron bars above them. The wall around the window is painted sloppily in lime wash, the foundations of the building coming undone where it meets the ground, rocks and red dirt at their feet. The end of the wall and the beginning of the earth don't quite fit each other, like fillings or crowns in your mouth that no longer sit well within your gums. Ishan fits perfectly in this landscape, and at the same time, he doesn't. If a person were in the dictionary under the word liminal, that would be Ishan. Even in photographs, maybe because he's got style, maybe because his body is constantly on the move, he's the type of person who never looks the same twice. He is here, and he isn't, and it is always like that. In his letter, he says I am his home, and asks me to make him my home. Soon, he writes, we will be home together. He believes it, so I believe it. It is like this pulsing beacon, seemingly so tangible, yet just out of reach. When you first begin to believe in love, you are invincible in your eagerness, green. I know I will meet Ishan long before we meet. It is happening. I am moving east. These days, I hold on to this idea of a powerful thing two people can create that transcends all boundaries, geographical, cultural, religious, racial. It makes perfect sense that love will conquer all, that two people can manifest a whole future out of a house of words, because words speak the truth, right? Though I find his long emails stifling from repetitive professions of love and sense the naivete in both of us, I find myself writing long, repetitive, stifling emails in return. It seems to be coming out of this well of love, one that convinces you that your bond is real and one of a kind. Is it an obsession? Call it by its right name. Need. It is the best kind of dream a young poet weaves. The attention we give each other through words via email for 2 years before we meet has a blooming effect. We energize each other. When my mother grows a new plant, she tells me the more she goes near it or talks to it and strokes its leaves, very gently, the crazier it blooms. She turns all her flowers toward me, she says, of her petunias, and I picture them exploding like a flare on her balcony. Ishan and I write each other pages and pages each week. If you're a writer and you don't censor your thoughts when speaking to someone, and that person writes you back without censoring themselves in return, you enter this vortex of loving the self in love. It happens very slowly at first, while you're inching toward it one email at a time, and then, like a spider sucked into the shower drain, you fall in, very deep, very fast. Good luck getting back out. It's as though I am Narcissus, who can't stop looking at his own image in the water. I can't stop writing, reading back what I wrote, and loving what I said. Can't stop reading and rereading what he said to me. At night, in dreams, I dream only words. During the day, I write to him, try to go to classes, and write poems. I am writing all the time. There is this sense of being drenched by language. Neither of us wants to put a stop to it. For a while, I live my life inside my head, composing emails, reading them, writing poems, posting them, critiquing other people's work, and reading other critiques of mine in online poetry workshops. As I'd done in my younger years in Albania, I found a way to avoid interaction with real people, meeting someone new, making some friends. I have no such courage. I've lived in Boston for a year and a half and hardly know my way around the city. I don't know how I managed to complete an advanced degree in English. I wanted to read and learn more, and I had hoped, too, that a master's degree would help me find a teaching job faster. So I do it all. I'm learning so much about craft and how I want to write. Some of the people I engage with only online become my first real creative writing teachers. Laurel K. Dodge, James Lineberger, Scott Autumn, Teresa Ballard, Lindsay, Jack Anders, Jenny Russell, and of course, Ishan. Living away from home and having the privacy of my own dorm room has only made things easier. That is, more possible to fully participate in a virtual life rather than living one. The neighbors are fast asleep. A boat has been anchored at the edge of the mind. It won't set sail, not tonight, not while you're away. You are the best part about me, he writes. I love you. Stop telling me you love me, I write back. It can be true, since we haven't even met in person. And then I don't hear from Ishan for days. Ani, I overdosed, he finally writes, almost a week later. He has taken amphetamines and cough syrup, something he's told me he uses habitually, like he does weed and alcohol, to write or to simply forget he's not where he wants to be. But this time he nearly dies. He says he was afraid he had lost me for good, and he took too much. The maid saved me, and a village homeopathic doctor. I am shaken. Ishan has nearly died, and I see myself having tried to take my own life once when I was 17. On the edges of my thinking, I feel somewhat responsible. Without me, Ishan seems entirely alone. With me, he is alive, in charge, ready to go anywhere. We bring out the best in each other, and isn't that a good sign to look for? Soon after this episode, I ask him to stop relying on weed and pills, and he does. Now there is an us to hold on to, which feels important. When something bothers Ishan, time seems to slow down. It feels like I have to wait an eternity to find out what has happened to him and why. But overnight, after we talk about it, the clouds clear, as though the world has only known sunlight. Sometimes we write new poems, and that is enough to put us in a better mood. He is happiest when he writes, but he has no local poetry community or resources. He loves his parents, yet feels estranged from them, having been enrolled in a boarding school 1,000 miles away at the age of 6. He wishes he could move to America, a culture whose movies, poetry, and music he adores, and I begin to dream it might be possible. After I finish graduate school, I take a teaching job in Thailand so I can be closer to India and finally meet Ishan. He will come to visit me in Thailand first, but before that, he sends me photos. There, in my hands, are the people from his village and his father's factory workers. In one of the photos, men tie up a cow with rope, preparing her for an operation, he says. Fields of cows and goats and langurs, eggplant flowers, butterflies, a temple with a rainbow above it, lush green rice fields, and women workers in blue saris, red, yellow, orange.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?